Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we celebrate Memorial Day, a national holiday devoted to recalling those men and women whose lives have been lost in the nation's wars or military involvements around the world. In today's show, we'll be exploring the personal meaning of military service and the impact of such a commitment on the lives of those who have served the nation, with historian Peter Karsten. Also, in our op-ed of the week, Medal of Honor recipient Senator Bob Kerry comments on what Memorial Day means to him. But first, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1962, Nazi leader and war criminal Adolf Eichmann was hanged for his role in the Jewish Holocaust. Beginning his military career in the Austrian National Socialist Party in 1933, Eichmann was eventually charged with leading the expulsion and extermination of Jews and Gypsies from Germany and its satellite states. At the conclusion of the war, Eichmann and his family fled from Allied forces and settled in Argentina. For years, he was the target of the Israeli Security Service, leading to his arrest and deportation to Israel for trial in 1960. Eichmann's attorneys claimed that he had no choice but to carry out the orders of his superiors, but the court disagreed, and he was found guilty. Eichmann was hanged at midnight on May 31, 1962, in Israel, and his ashes scattered over the sea beyond Israeli waters. Turning to items of interest in the news, while the West continues to butt heads with the government of Iraq, scholars from the United States and Europe recently joined Iraqi scholars in Baghdad to discuss the latest research and theories regarding the ancient Tower of Babel. While the Bible, ancient texts, and classical authors all make reference to a great structure gracing the Babylon skyline during the 6th century BC, modern scholars still question whether or not such a tower existed, and if it did, what it might have looked like. Among the most recent evidence unveiled at the conference was a cuneiform text with a detailed description of the tower attributed to Nebuchadnezzar of the 6th century before Christ. In the North Atlantic, historians and adventurers recently put their squabbles aside and their theories to the test. Recreating what many believe was the first trip from Europe to the New World, W. Hodding Carter sailed a replica of a Viking ship on an 87-day voyage from Greenland to the New World. The wooden ship, a type known as a nar, was powered only by a single square sail and oars manned by a crew of 10. Carter plans to donate the ship to L'Anse aux Meadows in Newfoundland, the only confirmed Viking settlement in the New World. And finally, an astronomer combing the archives of the Library of the University of California at Santa Cruz has discovered a 400-year-old horoscope by one of astronomy's great minds, Johannes Kepler. Written in German and displaying various zodiac symbols, the document plots and interprets the positions of stars at the time of the birth of an unnamed Austrian nobleman on September 10, 1586. You're listening to Talking History. This week, we celebrate Memorial Day. For some, it simply signals the beginning of summer. For others, it's the day on which we visit the burial places of our deceased loved ones and decorate their graves. Closer to its real meaning, on Memorial Day, we recall those lives lost in the nation's many wars. But of course, not all soldiers died. Many returned to civilian life, their lives often changed dramatically by the experience. Joining us is Dennis Mihalik, will talk to historian Peter Karsten about the influence of military service on the lives of those who served and survived.
Thank you, Brian. Today is Memorial Day, a national holiday established in 1868 that honors the ultimate sacrifice given by soldiers. For some soldiers, military service is a brief and inconsequential affair, while for others, it dramatically changes their lives. Here to put the influence of military service into historical perspective is Peter Karsten, professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, who is the author of several books on the subject, including Soldiers and Society, The Effects of Military Service in War on American Life. Recently, he has just finished editing the 5-volume encyclopedia titled The Military and Society, published by Garland Publishing. Welcome, Professor Karsten.
I'm pleased to be talking with you.
Well, in general, How does military service affect a soldier?
Well, there are some obvious ways, aren't there? I mean, physical losses in the event of combat or even in non-combat injuries can affect one, and these physical losses can include psychiatric loss or the advent of drug use. But there are other less obvious ones, such as altered socioeconomic status as a consequence of military service. For example, while white vets don't prove to be any better off than white non-vets, so we do know that Chicano vets are substantially better off within 10 years than those Chicanos who had not served in the military, and that this is attributable to something that those Chicanos picked up in military service. Mm-hmm. And then there's the propensity of people to, we speak of it as become more cosmopolitan as a consequence of their having served sometimes overseas. Persons who wouldn't otherwise see anything of the rest of the world return with a rather different outlook towards life. Their values, their personality may change. We're not talking minor speech and attire variations, but some change their political outlook and their personalities as well. I mean, we have evidence of this.
Mm-hmm. So then some of the generalizations that that many people are aware of, that is, from the kinds of even advertisements of the military service to entice people to join, like join the Navy and see the world, in many instances you're saying this does have a real impact on the soldier.
Yeah, some of those ads are very well crafted. Of course, that's a rather old one that you alluded to, but the Madison Avenue folks who advise the services follow up. They want to know whether the message that they think appeals to individuals in fact does, and how consistent it is with their military service. There's a nice study of the Be All You Can Be ad. You remember that one?
Yes.
Well, it turns out that the GIs, after they'd served for some time, when asked about that, felt that it was not a very good, an accurate message, that it didn't, that it promised more than had been delivered. And so the Army changed its message.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, considering the vast changes in the manner that wars are fought, in reading your research, I was really struck by the fact that that you stated that the attitudes and experiences of soldiers from the 18th, the 19th, the 20th century were more alike than different. Could you give us a couple of examples of that?
Yeah, well, of course, this is not to say that things don't change, but the historians tend to specialize in change and to ignore continuity. And I'm drawn to that that continuity. I found that however far back you went, you found the same the same significance of the primary group, of the bonding of soldiers in the colonial time and in the Revolution and Civil War. Again and again, the letters home, the reports on effective units and ineffective units spoke of the power of the primary group. We see in every war what has finally been described by the American Psychiatric Association as post-traumatic stress disorder, the long-term effects of observing the killing zone on the battlefield and participating. This has been as true of World War II and of World War I, of the Civil War, as it is of Vietnam. There are other examples of the kinds of desertions. Desertions were all throughout all of the experiences the United States has had in wartime. There have been deserters. There's been a charge that in the last half century, a softening has overcome American society and has led to greater degrees of desertion. And that's just baloney. There's much more. We have much more in common with the veterans of the past than we'd like to admit.
Mm-hmm. So if I hear you correctly, what you're saying is the continuity is in terms of human nature, and what's changing is the technology of war.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well put.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, well, why did it take you only 5 seconds to say that?
Well, because I've read your book very thoroughly. In discussing the consequences of military service, you interestingly divided the experience of the soldier into four stages or four different time frames. And the first was recruitment. Why is it important to analyze recruitment to judge the effects of military service?
Well, on the one hand, it's important to know who the individuals are who enter the service and what reasons they have for serving, those who are not simply draftees. In most of our experience, the typical soldier has been a volunteer, because unless you know who the individual is and what values he brought with him into the service, it's very hard to assess what the service experience may have done to that individual. All too often, we make the mistake of assuming that because someone has developed neuropsychiatric problems, for example, that it was his experience in the service which did this to him. We discovered in World War II, there was a team of social psychologists and sociologists who surveyed GIs, and then at the end of the war, they cross-correlated these earlier surveys with the outcome, with those who had become neuropsychiatric casualties and those who hadn't. And lo and behold, there's a strong predictor variable. Those who had answered questions upon being drafted in a certain fashion were much more likely to end up neuropsychiatric casualties than those who had not. That's one kind of reason that I think it's useful to know how individuals are recruited. But another is that if you're a draftee, you're simply more likely to become a casualty than if you're a volunteer. That was the case in Vietnam. It was the case in Korea as well. If you're drafted, you're more likely to end up with a combat MOS, military occupation specialty, and that matters. The process of getting the rank filled can affect us all as well. We think of press gangs in the past and the channeling process of the selective service system in the last 50 years ago. And let me also point out that there are moments when the Selective Service Act of 1940 exempted persons who were married. And lo and behold, you had a jump in the marriage rate. And then the Congress in early 41 altered that statute and said, well, we're only going to exempt persons who are married and have a child. And within 9 months, the birth rate jumped. You see? So the way people are drawn into the service has impact on not only those individuals, but others.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, obviously, in terms of your four stages, the actual tour of duty is the thing that lasts the longest, and has the potential of having the longest lasting effects. And in them all, combat, obviously, is the most intense experience. What are its potential effects on the soldier?
Well, we think of combat as having the capacity to turn persons into transform them, and there's some of that. We have two very good studies comparing those involved in heavy combat in Vietnam and those who had served in and experienced no combat or very little. And we do see some differences in their attitudes and behavior several years later. But this can be overstated. It doesn't turn people into violent criminals. That's never been the case, and we're misled if we think it does. I think it's sufficient to say that modern combat, and here I have to agree with those who believe in the significance of change over time, modern combat is is this most stressful possible, imaginable situation a young man can find himself in. And I think when that opening scene in the film Saving Private Ryan says it all. The lethality of the modern, of the 20th century battlefield simply makes the battlefields of the distant past feel into insignificance. The lethality has increased by factors of 15 and 20. That is, your likelihood of being killed has increased. You're in combat for a longer duration. These battles don't take one day, as Agincourt did in 1215. They take sometimes weeks and months, and they're vast. They are not what a single commander can see from a distant hilltop. They go on for miles. So individual commanders sometimes have very little capacity to control the units engaging in combat, as again you saw from that opening scene.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the most interesting things in your study was that you found that not only is there a fear of being killed, but that among soldiers there is actually a widespread fear of killing.
Yeah, it would appear. This may have been overstated by one of the first individuals to point it out systematically, General S. Alain Marshall, a journalist soldier in World War II, maintained in a book called Men Against Fire that only about 20 to 25% of the men fired their weapons at an enemy that was moving on them. This based upon interviews, post-combat interviews. That's probably an exaggeration on his part, we now suspect. But the Army bought that breed. They confirmed it with other kinds of information and changed their method of training as a consequence. Yes, clearly people find that Judeo-Christian unwillingness to kill difficult to overcome, even when faced with an enemy moving on you.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Marshall's study in World War II. Is this confirmed by other kinds of evidence from earlier wars?
Well, there's a curious report that Fred Shannon shares with us of the circumstances at Gettysburg, where a post-combat survey of the battlefield found how many? Hundreds? Were they in the numbers of thousands of muskets that had been flung to the ground or dropped by a wounded or killed individual? And several of them had more than one round jammed down the barrel, and several had as many as six rounds. Some of these individuals may simply have panicked, but you have to believe that a number of them wanted to give the impression that they were firing, but were unwilling to do so. Stonewall Jackson remarked once in a report that his North Carolinians wouldn't fire, and when made to fire, they'd fire clearly over the heads of the enemy. Now, he was probably talking about some North Carolinians who were intensely religious. We don't know. But there seems to be evidence. This is an understudied subject, and we need more work on it, but there's clear evidence that certain individuals, more so than others, aren't able to bring themselves to kill.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very interesting observation in terms of, again, human nature and in terms of what individuals have to face going into battle. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Peter Karsten of the University of Pittsburgh.
Recently, a Liberty Elm tree on the nation's Capitol grounds in Washington, D.C. was dedicated to Senator Bob Kerry of Nebraska. Kerry, former Navy lieutenant and SEAL squad leader in the Vietnam War, who lost his right leg below the knee in a grenade explosion, was awarded the Medal of Honor in 1970. And much like those veterans we just discussed, it was an experience that changed the course of his life. We've asked Senator Kerry to share with us his thoughts on Memorial Day.
For me, Memorial Day is a day that I try to get away from the habit of forgetting and make an affirmative effort to remember it, and to remember that men and women before us have sacrificed their freedom, have gone in harm's way, and have, in some cases, given up their lives for our freedom. And we hear that a lot, and it becomes a cliche. It becomes something that we think, well, maybe it doesn't happen because just there's a sort of a habit of saying, and there might not be anything behind it. But there's a lot behind it. There are men who did land on Omaha Beach in their early 20s, young men, frightened, probably sick from riding the boats across the English Channel, facing terrible odds. Terrible odds. There was not only no guarantee, but a high probability that they would be killed. They could hear the bullets slamming against the landing craft, and they knew that when the doors were dropped, they were likely to be shot, and yet they dropped the doors, and they landed on the beach, and they fought their way up the hills, and they beat back the Germans, and they won the war. And as a consequence, we have freedom. Likewise in the Pacific, likewise even in our most controversial war, Vietnam, where there was a lot of doubt, a lot of disagreement, and I myself concluded that the war was a mistake. But it wasn't a mistake for us to put our lives on the line for the freedom of strangers, in this case, the freedom of the South Vietnamese, who today appreciate, and sometimes more than we do, that young men from the United States of America were willing to fly all the way over to Southeastern Asia and risk a great deal. I had the pleasure of sitting and listening to Kim Dae-jung, the new president of South Korea, talk to a joint session of Congress, and he looked right to us as representatives of the American people and said, remember, you saved our lives. You came here and after we were attacked from the North, and as a result, we don't have communism in South Korea. We have democracy. We have freedom. We have the freedom to speak and the freedom to travel and all the freedoms that you enjoy in the United States of America. So it's important on Memorial Day that at least one day we pause and remember the young men and women who are here because they died in defense of freedom, and the young men and women whose health was damaged, and the young men and women who just gave up their freedoms and who continue to do so. The million, 300,000 Americans who service in the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard, all the men and women who are in our National Guard and Reserves, they are not just wearing a uniform. They're wearing a uniform that means that they are defending our freedoms. And we should remember it, we should honor it, and we should pledge never to forget.
You've been listening to Bob Kerry, military veteran, Medal of Honor winner, and U.S. Senator from Nebraska. This is Talking History. Welcome back to Talking History. During our summer shows for our Site of the Week segment, we like to recommend historic places you and your family might enjoy visiting. Here to describe one such lovely historic site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Saratoga Springs, New York is a wonderful, often overlooked gem of a vacation spot. While it is best known for its thoroughbred horse racing season, which is in full swing from July to Labor Day, there is much more to Saratoga Springs than horses. History is very much a part of the area, which is located in the foothills of the Adirondack Mountains. While you may want to stop and take the waters, as the area is known for their healing powers, there are plenty of historical sites to see. Stop and see the short film of the 1777 Revolutionary War battle at the Saratoga National Historic Site, and then take the nine-mile journey along the sites where events led to the surrender of the British General Gentleman Johnny to the American rebels. Or stop and see the 155-foot-tall Saratoga Battle Monument. For three seasons, you can hike, bike, drive, or ride horses through most of the battlefield, and in the winter, you can traverse the area on skis or snowshoes.
Thank you, Cindy. And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we have two very interesting but quite different museum exhibits to call to your attention. First, at the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C., check out an exhibit on the work of famed photographer Edward Curtis. The exhibit, which runs through September 17th, features images from Curtis's comprehensive 20-volume study, The North American Indian, which he carried out from 1907 to 1930. And further west, opening on June 27th at the Detroit Institute of Arts, will be the exhibit Ancient Gold. They had no alphabet and left no documents about their culture. What we know about the ancient Thracians, who occupied land in what is now part of Bulgaria, northern Greece, western Turkey, and Romania, comes from the writings of their neighbors, especially the Greeks and Romans, and from the artifacts that archaeologists have extracted from their tombs and burial mounds. Ancient gold includes more than 200 gold and silver objects found in those excavations, dating from 4000 BC to 400 AD. For further information on these exhibits, contact the National Museum of American History and the Detroit Institute of Arts. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week when our subject will be the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian Lebeau. Thank you.